Good evening and welcome to the Boston Public Library. My name is Henry Scannell. I'm the curator of microtext and newspapers here at the library. Tonight we have speaking for us Lawrence Larry DeCara, who was born in Dorchester. He's an attorney and politician who is currently a partner at Nixon Peabody. For over 40 years, he has been intimately involved with the development process in Boston. While he was a student, I believe, at college, he actually was elected to the Boston City Council as the youngest person ever elected to that body. In 1978, he was the council president. He's former chairman of the Boston Municipal Records Bureau, Research Bureau, and former chairman of A Better City. He's a graduate of the Boston Latin School. I was a few years behind him and recall seeing him there at the time. He's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts, Harvard University and the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Suffolk University, and Harvard College. Turmoil and Transition in Boston, his book, is his political memoir, shows how public policy decisions and the economic and demographic changes following the busing crisis of the 1970s transformed Boston into one of the most affluent, diverse, and successful cities of the current century. In addition to practicing law, Larry DeCara has taught at several local universities, including Harvard, UMass, and BU. And the Boston Public Library is very proud and pleased to present Lawrence Larry S. DeCara.
Thank you, Henry. And thank you to all of you for braving this very difficult evening. It is difficult not only because of the temperature, but because I'm competing with the governor and the president of the United States. But they won't be autographing books, and they'll be on TV. So throughout the day, emails have come in, phone has been ringing, I have to do this with the president, I have to do this with the governor. So I'm very appreciative of all the people who've made it out here this evening. And many of you have known me for so long, you've probably heard some of the stories in the book. And with the passing of Pete Seeger, who I actually heard sing at the UMass campus when I was a young counselor at Boys State over 40 years ago, I remember that poster from that era, "What if they gave a war and nobody came?" So I'm glad that we didn't have to suggest why did they give a lecture and nobody came. So I'm very, very happy for everyone being here today. Over more than 50 years, I've spoken in hundreds of venues across this country, never really counted it, maybe 10,000 times. In recent weeks, I've been speaking about my book across Massachusetts and in Washington, on college campuses, in dining rooms, libraries, fancy clubs. I've spoken before powerhouse political women in Brookline, gay men surrounding a dinner table in Jamaica Plain, book clubs, history and government classes. None of that, however, can compare to my honor this evening and speaking at the Boston Public Library. This institution, built by the people and dedicated to the advancement of learning, has played an important role in my life, as it has in the lives of many millions of others who have lived in this city. Before I address the essential points of the little volume, let me speak about my relationship with books and with the library. My parents were children of the Depression. My father grew up in abject poverty, but he always had access to books. Both of my parents, throughout their lives, were avid readers. And the Boston Public Library was where they obtained the books that they read. I followed in their footsteps. Enrolling in the summer reading club at the Dorchester Lower Mills branch, where Mrs. Carney, later Mrs. Crowley, took us under her wing. I spoke with her just a few years ago. She was in her 90s. It was the first prize I ever received. I still have the book. It was the first time I ever was on radio, but certainly not the last. And in the book, I talk about my first serious research assignment when I was 10 years old in the fifth grade. It was about the Rosetta Stone and the Rhine Papyrus. And Daddy had purchased a set of used Encyclopedia Britannica from George Gloss, Brattle Bookstore, whose son, Kenny, has been my friend from Little League and Latin School, and is to this day. And there wasn't enough in the Encyclopedia Britannica, those big, thick volumes with small print, as I recall, about the Rosetta Stone and the Rhine Papyrus. Mother insisted, "Son, we will go to Copley Square." Remember, folks, this was 1960. Almost everybody smoked. We didn't. And the glorious McKim building was a bit dingy, certainly very different from the beautiful structure that so many of us have participated in restoring. Today, murals can be viewed again, and no one would dare to smoke in the library, and let's hope it stays that way forever. Thus began my love affair with this glorious real estate in the heart of our city, where those words etched in granite remind us of the importance of learning. And I was in attendance at the dedication of this building a bit more than 40 years ago. And I think it's fair to say it may not be perfect, but I expect it'll be better in the future. But it's also a very important building in our city, because many, many cities never built after they had an original library structure. And of course, this lecture hall was named after one of our trustees at the time, Sidney Rabb, who was a graduate of Latin School, I think, do the math, 51 years ahead of me, but who's counting? Now, on to the book. Turmoil and Transition is a memoir, and it's very personal in nature, and perhaps more confessional than I would have ever anticipated, but it's also a history book. And a few of my friends have said, "Why did you talk about that? And why did you admit to that?" Well, one of the great things about having been in politics in one's 20s is most of the people of whom I speak are dead. It's a real advantage to that. And I've yet to hear from Louise Day Hicks or Dapper O'Neill or anybody else about what I said about them. But it is a book about the city. This city, where I have lived my entire life and in which I've played an active role wearing many different hats for over 40 years. The essential conclusion, very simple, cities reinvent themselves and so do people. Perhaps appropriately, very appropriately, the book's publication coincided with the election of a new mayor in Boston and the creation of a new electoral map, about which I wrote a major article for Commonwealth Magazine. In short, class, more than race, was the essential political variable determining who voted for whom in last fall's election. And looking back at all the years of political statistics, all the years going back to the 60s, I'm precocious, but I wasn't that good when I was in diapers. On nearly every occasion, Roxbury and South Boston were voting for different candidates. Well, not this year. The map has changed. And the black community, the minority community in general, was no longer aligned with the upper middle class folks who live within walking distance of where we are today. When I was at Latin School, I had this little book where I now have the Coop book. I'm a member of the Coop. I hope people are members. I'm their lawyer. And I had a little book, and it had sayings for each day. And one of them was from Giuseppe Mazzini, the great Italian patriot, and it is, "Change is the moral order of the universe." Great all-purpose quote, come in handy for about 50 years. How true. How true it is for Boston, and how true it is for each of us. I grew up in the city, and I get a pretty good idea that I'm probably close in age to the majority of people here. We grew up in the city that was usually compared to St. Louis and Detroit and Cleveland. We were the cities that had rapid declines in population in the years after the war. We were the cities which had dramatic racial change. We were the cities where the core industries were no longer viable. Boston's being compared to St. Louis and Cleveland and Detroit stopped a long time ago. I would argue what happened in the city, what happened to the city, is a direct result of the turmoil, the political turmoil of the 70s. We transitioned to a very different city. Now, part of it was good fortune. And without any doubt, part of it was political leadership. Certainly, it was not the weather. What happened beginning in the 70s, and I was there on the front lines, is that people who wanted to live in the city, people who were committed to a city open to all, moved in, especially in the 70s, those who felt uncomfortable with the city we were becoming moved out. Ted White, another Latin school boy from Dorchester, speaks of the ballet, which is the story of cities. And the ballet was very rapid in the 70s in Boston. Although no one can prove it to the exact person, I would argue we probably lost 10% of our population, over 50,000 people, between 70 and 76. Dramatic decline in population. Today, we are less tribal. We are less Catholic. We are less blue-collar. And sadly, we are a city of fewer children and therefore fewer little leagues. More than in most other cities, this happened quickly, and it continues to happen. In short, Boston has become, for the most part, a city where all are welcome. That's what many of us dreamed about when we were working at City Hall in the 1970s. I go to the church at the Paula Center, and we sang that hymn, all are welcome, in this place on Sunday. And the night before, I attended that benefit for the Bar Association at the MFA. And my job was to accompany Mayor Menino, and then we were greeted by Mayor Walsh, and I stepped back, and the Globe thankfully took a picture, and my daughter put it on Facebook, because she knows how to put things on Facebook. I do not. And I was thinking, sitting in church on Sunday when we were singing that song, that I attended Bar Association events 30, 40 years ago. Mostly old, sort of old, stuffy people, as I recall. There were same-sex couples at this event, and they felt welcome. There were multiracial couples at this event, many of them, and they felt welcome. And perhaps a third, a half of the people there may have been couples of mixed religion. And there were solo people as well. And truth be told, a young man was there with a date, and I'm not so sure whether the date was him or her, and that's fine also. So we talked about, in the 70s, all of us young, idealistic people, many of whom have worked for Kevin White, about how we envisioned the city of the future, and to some extent, that's the city it has become. It's also a very different city in terms of the built environment. And I think that's because of political leadership. Let me elaborate. There's probably a few people here who remember Scully Square. I remember it's being torn down. I remember Brattle Bookstore having to move. And maybe someone here may have been to the old Howard. What was it, old Mr. Hatch? Wrote the song, "Who Was the Coward Who Tore Down the Old Howard?" But the folks in power in Boston in the early 60s, when I was at Latin School, had the courage to tear down flop houses and burlesque establishments and tattoo parlors and sailor bars and all the other things I am told were in Scully Square. Controversial. People worked in those establishments. People owned that property. Eminent domain is not always fair. And we built Government Center. Setting aside the brutalist architecture of that era, the fact that Government Center was created, and they changed the Green Line, Blue Line stop from Scully Square to Government Center, meant that a newly minted mayor, Kevin White, came to City Hall, I believe it was the middle of 69, would stare out his window and look at a decrepit, abandoned Quincy Market with but a few merchants left in the central building and the central artery behind it. I talk about it in the book. I'd never talked to Kevin White in my life before my election. The phone rang at 86 Cobman Hill Avenue, 265-8318. My mother picked it up. When I got home, she said, "The mayor wants to meet with you." So I had my best blue suit and my best white shirt, and she ironed it and starched it and everything else, and I went in to see Mayor White. And there he was, as some of you met with him, you know, he would be, his arms would be on that sort of bronze rail that we have so many of at City Hall. He'd be staring off into the distance. Never anything on a desk with Kevin White. And I said, how do I get this man's attention? And I walk up right next to him and I said, "Nice view." And he says, "Don't get any funny ideas, kid." Remember that real well. So Kevin spent years looking out that window. And that meant that he had the political courage to enter into a long-term lease with the Rouse Company, to borrow $4.8 million, I think it was, to restore the building so the bricks weren't falling down, so Rouse would take it over. And that was a 6-3 vote in the City Council, a brutal vote, a tough vote, because we knew we were taking away people's livelihoods, and we were putting people in their place. And there was a guy who was in the meat business. I remember him coming to me. His grandson, still my friend, talking about what this meant to his business. And then, if one thinks of it, for a while, Quincy Market would say there were more tourists who visited Quincy Market than visited Disney World. That included a lot of people who maybe went 5-7 times a week. But the statistic was correct. And what did they look at when they went to the end of Quincy Market? This decrepit, rusting highway. And it was dripping water and was just really grotesque. Walking underneath was an adventure. And I would argue that but for people being confronted by that aging monstrosity, there might not have been the political will to put the highway system underground, make it more efficient, create green space. Also, we have all new utilities in the downtown area as a result. And I was involved with Norman Leventhal, another Dorchester boy who went to Latin School, with the Artery Business Committee, as we called ourselves. And we worked very hard to be sure that that worked and the city did not stop in the process of construction. And there were a lot of people who were against putting the central artery below ground, not only because of cost, but because of disruption. There are always naysayers. Whatever decision someone in public life is faced with, there are always people who are against it because there are winners and losers in any political equation. So I believe, and I talk about it in the book, that Kevin White and Michael Dukakis deserve enormous credit for having the political courage to rehabilitate Quincy Market and to tear down the Central Artery. So, as a result, we have now seen that the seaport, which was 20 years ago, Anthony's Pier 4, Father Martin's Chapel, and a bunch of parking lots, is now bursting with activity. 30 million square feet, either up or approved. It's no longer necessary to walk underneath the highway to get there. Highway system services that part of the city. One is closer to the airport when one is at the seaport than one is to the airport when one is at extensions of airports in other parts of the country. That's how close it is. So decisions made in the early 60s, when I was at Boston Latin School, resulted in economic growth 50 years later. And that is also the saga of the city. Now, in the book and in questions or whatever discussion people want to engage in, I could elaborate about the Post Office Square Park, which required another mayor, Ray Flynn, to stand up to another property owner, Frank Sawyer, or the Southwest Corridor, which many of us fought in the early 70s, and the fact that the Southwest Corridor is now below where most of us live means that Jamaica Plain is a very different place, and Teresa and I have been there for about a quarter of a century. Not so sure we would have moved there if you still had that rusted orange line going down Washington Street. So the scenarios are different, my friends, but the essential ingredient is enlightened political leadership. And those are some of the examples of decisions which impact urban life, which impact our lives. That's the message of turmoil and transition. Once again, thank you very much, all of you, for joining us this evening.